Welcome to States and Migration in Europe. We have reached 12 episodes so far, and this is the 13th episode. This episode will be a recap of the first 12 episodes. We are going to reflect on the key insights from the first 12 episodes and also reflect on the ways this podcast fits into the broader media landscape about migration in European affairs. To have this recap, I am very happy to have with me Francis Gilles, who is a seasoned journalist with 50 years of experience covering various issues, but mostly focusing on Maghreb questions and the relationship of the Maghreb with Europe, which is, of course, central in our reflection on migration. So, Francis, thank you very much for accepting to take part in this episode.
Thank you. Very nice to be with you.
With Francis, we are going to discuss the various episodes we have had so far, and Francis will share his expertise and experience as a journalist to highlight what this series has so far brought and the prospects for this series. Let's start first with the key insights we can draw from 12 episodes in the series of States and Migration in Europe. There have been three sub-series so far. Each of those three sub-series have had four episodes. We have had a first sub-series on key actors of migration affairs in Europe, namely Turkey, in which we had Sanem Düzgid from Istanbul to talk, Alberto Cunha talking about Germany. You, Francis, came to talk about France, and Alain Zizet from Glasgow talked about the UK. So that was the first part about the major states in Europe. We had a second part in which we explored the question of migration control for states from a variety of perspectives, a historical perspective about Hitler with Brendan Sims, a more contemporary perspective about the control of refugees and the role of refugees in the war in Ukraine with Ivan Kanchanovsky. We had already in this section some reflection on the media landscape with Lucila Rodriguez Alarcón and how to inform about migration at the time of immigration restrictions at Europe's external borders. And also we had Phil Magness to discuss the philosophy of Ludwig von Mises about immigration. So that's what the second sub-series in the podcast. And then we had a third sub-series, which was devoted to the immigration challenge in Europe. We had Ivan Crowley, top expert about migration to Europe, the flows of migrants from Africa and the Near East to Europe. We had also Maurizio Ambrosini from Milan, who is also a top expert in irregular migrants in Europe. So in this immigration challenge sub-series, we have followed migrants in their journey from Africa or the Near East to Europe. And then with Maurizio Ambrosini, we investigated the life of irregular migrants in Europe. We had Anna Triandafilidou, which addressed and tackled the questions whether states can control migration and about the legitimacy to control migration. And also we had part of this sub-series, Mohamed Ali Adraoui, who reflected on the question of terrorism and whether Salafism, that is to say a cultural characteristic of immigrants, or even more broadly, a characteristic of Islam, could be related to jihadism. So these were the three sub-series. The major actors, migration control, and the immigration challenge. Before moving on to the key insight we have drawn from this series, Francis, what are your thoughts about this organization, this structure of the various series so far?
Migration is part of the broader picture, which is economics, politics, also the immense attraction Europe exerts on many other countries. People forget in Europe that most migrants in Africa go to other African countries. It's only a minority which comes to Europe. Most migration goes to neighboring African countries, and the same is true in Asia. There is an immense attraction of Europe, whatever the problems in Europe, because of what you can earn, for the greater freedom. Europe as a magnet, which is also prompted by the fact that many African states have, in fact, done very poorly in terms of economic development in the last 50 years since independence. And then you have the movements of immigrants due to political crisis, refugees, you've got Afghanistan, you've got Syria, and so on. So the movement is unstoppable. The European policy fails because first, you probably can't close your borders, however much you try. We're not willing to accept this reality, so everything's reduced to controlling frontiers, to the fear that we as white people are going to be swamped by Muslims, Asians, whatnot. And this just forgets the fact that already France and Britain have had immigrants from their former colonies. In the case of France, it started in the 1920s. In Britain, it started in the 1940s, although if you include the white Commonwealth, Australia, Canada, it started well before the Second World War. So we are used to a certain amount of mixing, and whatever the tensions, we have a way of dealing with it, which is more or less good. But countries like Germany is quite new because it started with the Turks after the 1950s. Italy, it's even newer because Italy was a country of emigration until the 1960s. And in the last 20 years, it's reversed itself completely. And it's now facing large numbers, not least because of its geographical position, same with Greece, which was a country of emigration until quite recently, and now faces large arrivals of Asians and Arabs and Africans. So it's just a subject which touches upon every facet of our life in Europe, but of course one of the reasons, but not the only one, for accepting, if not encouraging, immigration was to fill in lower class jobs, poorly paid jobs. The employers were quite clear in England and France and Germany that they welcomed immigration because it allowed them to pay workers less. And furthermore, everybody was convinced until the 1970s that these people would return home. Well, they never did. They brought their families. So hence a whole new sociology was created in Europe. And we have become much more diverse. So in a way, whichever way you organize the series, immigration touches is at the nexus, at the point of contact of all the problems of Europe, including security, because it is our intervention in Iraq, our intervention in Libya, the war in Afghanistan, the Syria crisis. It's all these crises which have prompted large numbers of people to move.
Absolutely, Francis. Thank you very much for painting this very broad picture of all the stakes and how the topic of this podcast series interacts basically with most dimensions of contemporary European affairs and politics. So let's move on now to see what kind of answers we have had so far in the series about those very big questions. The first sub-series was devoted to major states, with namely Turkey, Germany, France, and the UK. We first started with Turkey and explored the very particular position Turkey has had in this affair, because Turkey has been a country that has been in the very recent years gradually moving into a country of immigration, while at the same time being the major gatekeeper of Europe. And this has also reinforced its mutation into a country of immigration, because Europe has constructed Turkey as a dead end. So Turkey occupies a very specific position in this landscape, while Germany, as we discussed with Alberto Cunha, remains the major actors that hold the system together, both as far as internal freedom of movement in Europe is concerned, and as far as these attempts for immigration restrictions at Europe's outer borders continue. What we saw about France and the UK is a slightly different picture. With France, it was with you, Francis, and the UK was with Alain Zisset, we thought that the question of immigration is gradually transforming the very basic condition of politics in those countries. That is, immigration in both France and the UK has become such an important and salient issue that it interacts with the very political system, that it has the capacity to transform the political system in those countries. We mentioned that at the time of the elections in France in 2022, we were facing growing personalization of power, which was itself part of the centralization of power. And the migration challenge is always presented as a major reason for this transformation. In the UK, we have been seeing the encroachments between the European Court of Human Rights and the Home Office, especially in the British government. And likewise, how the immigration policy of the Home Office is touching upon some fundamental principle of British politics and more broadly of the post-war European order. So highlighting those various national cases, we really found what you were saying, Francis, that is that immigration touches upon, especially in France and the UK, the very fabric of those countries. The only countries that remain a bit of top of that is clearly Germany. But we don't know for how long Germany will be able to keep the system stable. Germany has been struggling to keep Europe united in the face of migration crisis or inflows of migrants from outside Europe. And likewise, Germany has been struggling to keep Turkey stable in this situation. So the entire situation from the point of view of the major state actors is unstable. Do you agree with those four actors being in this predicament?
It's a failure surrounding Brexit. In other words, a group of politicians managing for one reason or another to convince a majority of British people to leave Europe on the fear of immigration. But what is interesting in England for me is that some of the people who implement the harshest measures are Home Secretaries who are of Indian or Pakistani origin. I mean, that is the most extraordinary thing. The most racist views about people coming into England are expressed by notably women of Asian origin. It is one of the extraordinary paradoxes in France. The Minister of the Interior is partly of Algerian origin, and you get to some extent the same phenomenon in England. But then this goes to a deeper thing in England. There's a major crisis of confidence in the future of the country, which in a way Brexit expressed. People voted for Brexit. The poorer North voted out of resentment at government policies. And then a certain number of people in the middle or upper middle classes was still dreaming of empire because the empire was huge and defined Britain for 150 or 200 years. Having said that, when you are in Britain, look at the number of senior offices of state held by people who come from the immigration, to start with the prime minister. And so you have Asians, blacks, the foreign secretary is black. At the same time, you get a lot of tensions about the way the British not respecting the rules of asylum. That probably has more to do, though, with the fact that the rules of asylum, as they were defined after the Second World War, are no longer suited to the purpose. Because you cannot tell the difference very often between somebody seeking asylum for political and economic reasons. And there's a lot of economic immigration, but a lot of it is dressed up as political. So the whole framework of the 1940s no longer works. In the case of Britain, the majority of British people recognize Brexit was a mistake, and efforts are being made to mend fences with the European Union. Whether that'll make the immigration issue less difficult or not, I simply don't know. In the case of France, there's been this fear of decline of a once very powerful country, which always saw its culture as the beacon of the world. That's a very particular French thing since the revolution. And the immigrants, particularly from North Africa or Black Africa, just confuse the whole issue. Quite a few people have not accepted Algerian independence, which was 60 years ago. This fear of decline in France goes back to the late 19th century. It goes back to Maurice Barrès. You can find people in the 30s, and then the Le Pens in the 1960s, Poujad. This fear of decline came from the First World War, the fact that the French population was declining in the 30s, and the defeat in the Second World War, the defeat in Algeria, all this created a feeling that the nation was in deep decline. Britain managed its decolonization better, just never felt. The danger today is that everybody from the center and the right is racing towards the extreme right to always define things in terms of Islam and terrorism, which of course doesn't work. And even the head of state cannot stop himself suggesting by innuendo that Islam and the recent riots in the suburbs, somehow Islam has something to do with it, when in fact anybody in his right mind knows that it's basically problems of failure to integrate economically, failure to find jobs, dressed it up in cultural terms. And then the debate gets polarized, and you end up with a kind of public debate on television, which is moving more and more to the right.
So indeed, as you say, the very political debate is deeply transformed by this issue, especially in France and the UK. In the second sub-series, we explored some aspects of migration control. We had first Brendan Sims, who explained how migration was central to Hitler's worldview, that Hitler was deeply worried not by immigration, but by emigration of Germans, especially overseas to the United States. Hitler was convinced, and this is where it connects to our series, that managing this migration was central for the future of Germany. And what Brendan Sims explained very well in the series is that Hitler failed on migration. Hitler had a very big project, in particular, organizing the settlements of German migrants in Crimea, in Ukraine, and around the Black Sea. And all this failed completely, even within the Third Reich, as it was in the early 1940s. Hitler was deeply unable to manage migration, to populate certain areas and transfer population from one corner to the other. So the question of migration control has been Hitler's big failure, which also contributed to his fall. So that, I think, was a very interesting insight about the difficulty for states to control migration. The question also of migration control has contaminated libertarianism, as Phil Magness came to explain in an episode of the series. Phil reviewed how one prominent figure of contemporary libertarian thought, namely Anselm and Hoppe, has been taking very vocal positions against immigration, while the consistency of the argument escaped me. So what Phil Magness has done in the series is to show how the philosophy of Ludwig von Mises, who is the founding father of contemporary libertarianism, was not against immigration, quite the contrary. He had a classical libertarian vision that movement of people should be free. Some have tried to argue that it was not the case, that he was actually racist, but it's not convincing. And so within libertarian studies, there was nevertheless this tension embodied by Anselm and Hoppe that would apply the liberty principles to a variety of areas, but not to migration. It doesn't mean that states should not control migration, but we can see that the importance of immigration restrictions went as far as affecting libertarianism with the positions of Anselm and Hoppe. And then this question of migration control came back with the Ukraine crisis. Hitler was convinced that the key for Germany power was in the management of migration. We saw that coming back with the war in Ukraine, in which suddenly the welcoming and accommodation of 8 million refugees, some of them were internally displaced, was a major stake in this confrontation, one that will imply how long Ukraine could fight with the necessary manpower, one that implied also how much Ukraine could repopulate some territories from which people had fled the Russian army. So Ivan Kachanovsky explained to us how migration became a central stake in the war. And already before the outbreak of the war, migration had contributed to the destabilization of Russian influence because you had an increasing number of people who wanted to get closer to the European Union to benefit from the freedom of movement and be able to move west. So migration here has a transformative power and will certainly contribute to the final outcome of this war. Last in this sub-series of migration control, we had Lucila Rodriguez Alarcón, who explained how an industry of migration control has emerged at Europe's borders and is itself extremely powerful. These are very big companies, and they make a lot of revenues with migration control. They could also represent a very important lobby. So this subsidiary was quite eclectic, emphasizing the importance of migration for states and identifying the growing contentious aspect of the issue and the difficulty of states to achieve this control, relying increasingly on private firms to do that.
There is maybe a broader issue here that in the world in the last 40 years, as globalization, in other words, increase of a greater exchange of money, of trade, of goods and everything. At the same time, we've been restricting the movement of people towards Europe, and that's totally contradictory. You end up with what you ended up today. The ingenious ways people in North Africa have of getting to France is quite extraordinary. But these stories are not often told because the people who know them wouldn't talk about them publicly. Well, the other thing is the extent to which criminal gangs have got into this. There's a lot of money at stake. When you just look at how much it costs for a sub-Saharan immigrant to move by boat from Tunisia to Italy, you know, you are speaking of thousands of euros. So you think, how do these people have this money? But they do. Because they're financed by whole communities in Africa to come to Europe, you know. So there's a huge increase in criminal activity, which is a major problem for Europe. That increase in criminal activity has happened in every walk of life. It's happened in drugs. It's happened with trading women on a big scale. The increase in the criminal activity was partly the result of the collapse of the Soviet Union, because in 1991, the criminal gangs which existed in Russia already, and the journalists and researchers who wrote a book on this in the 1990s, Misha Gleni, explained how the Yugoslav wars allowed the Russian gangs or the Ukrainian gangs to move into Western Europe on all kinds of fronts. When you look at the recent French riots, one of the main factors which brought them to an end was when the big drug barons said after 5 or 6 days of heavy police presence on the streets, enough is enough because it's harming the drug trade. And they just blew a whistle and everything stopped. And so it wasn't the police or the state or whatever. The drug barons played a major role. When the president of France, after 5 or 6 days, went to visit a police commissariat in the 17th arrondissement of Paris, he was told this to his face by the police officers, and he was left speechless. But at the same time, one should say, when speaking about immigration, one should not forget the positive side, in the sense that when you walk the streets of Paris or any major French city, when you walk the streets of London, the number of people who are Black or Arab or Asian holding good jobs is huge. 40% of London, 45% of London wasn't born in London. So there are the negative sides of all these problems, but there are also immensely positive sides. I suspect that it makes society, French society, British society, much more dynamic. If you take Spain, because the majority of refugees have been Latin American. So being Catholic and speaking Spanish, in a way, they're easier to integrate than the Moroccans. So in Spain, there are far fewer tensions than in France.
There are many things in what you have said that are very well connected to what we have discussed. The first thing you have said is that Whereas the global economy has gone increasingly interdependent, the cross-border flows of everything have increased. States have tried to restrict immigration. So that was a very big challenge for them to do that. And as you say, many migrants became extremely ingenious in order to bypass those controls. And to a large extent, the problems that states are facing today with migration have been the result of the criminal networks where helping migrants to cross borders that states were closing. The rise of those networks within countries of those criminal networks, you refer to the drug barons, has been also an outcome of state intervention to restrict immigrants' employment, including via regulation of the labor market, things like minimum wage and so on. The young people between 13 and 18, they have two roads ahead of them. Those who are immigrants or immediate descendants of immigrants, either they go for the low-skilled labor market or they go to criminality. This is the dilemma of the young people between the low-skilled labor market or criminality. And as states have made access to the legal low-skilled labor market increasingly difficult, they have just favored a number of those young people to move into criminality. And then once you had the critical number of young people in certain areas moving into criminality, everybody would do that.
In France, it's very difficult to access the labor market if you're waiting for your papers.
So what we see is that states have been paradoxically more successful when they try to achieve freedom of movement than when they try to achieve restrictions. And then we had the last sub-series about the immigration challenge, how migrants move to Europe. And with Evan Crowley, we saw especially how the categories of asylum seeker economic migrants are misleading because in the complexity of individual experience, none of those categories often works, which echoes as well the difficulty for states to allocate migrants into categories. We saw with Maurizio Ambrosini how irregular migrants can live in Europe, who owes them, how they work, and what are the implications. And so we came to discuss with Anatri and Philidou whether states can regulate migration, and with Mohamed El Yadraoui whether there was any link between cultural diversity and the question of terrorism. And the conclusion here so far is, again, that states have themselves created a big chunk of this problem through their restrictive immigration policies that created a machine that transformed migrants into irregular and then may transform those irregular into possibly criminal and in some cases, why not as well, terrorists. What you were saying, that the debate on migration is increasingly moving towards the right, if not the extreme right, can prepare the last part now about the media landscape. Now we have political channels that are devoted to highlighting how immigration is dangerous. So you make a correlation, that is, you see those rioters, they were Black and Arab. Okay, so this means that immigration is a problem. Not necessarily. What if these are your policies that transformed immigrants into rioters? The impact on public policies is quite extensive on those people. And as Epictetus was saying, there are things you can change and there are things you cannot change. And you should focus your attentions on the things you can change. The mobility of people is something that is unavoidable in the world in which we live, given the transportation system, the communication system. It's extremely hard to prevent people from moving. It's not about preventing water from flowing somewhere. Water is not smart. People are smart and they will avoid the obstacles. So what states can control are their own policies rather than the movement of people. And their own policies should be tailored to avoid transforming migrants into potential criminals and to facilitate their integration. Most of the problems immigrants encounter in their integration are state-made. Policies of immigration restrictions are simply accentuating those problems. That's why after half a century of immigration restrictions, the problem has not gone better. It has just gone worse in all European countries. So that's the issue of the immigration challenge. With my guest, we could conclude that it's extremely hard for states to control migration. And many of the problems are state-made, but you have very big voices in the media landscape today who are based on saying the opposite, and I believe are not really ready to an intellectual discussion.
Point about the media, this particularly true in France, is that there is a doxa on every subject. If I take my friends in France, many people don't look at television anymore. They don't look at the news. They've stopped looking at news on television. They listen a bit to radio. They just don't look at television. And in any case, when it comes to the younger people, they get informed by social media.
The traditional media landscape was heavily connected to the state. What you will not have in those channels is an argument that the state policies in themselves could be responsible for the problem. The only valid positioning is to ask for more state intervention. And immigration restrictions is part of that. That is, they will be calling for states to solve the problem, to have more policies, to maybe have restrictions here and there, to help migrants here and there. But they will never tell you that policies may be the problems in the first place. The decentralization of information through social networks, which is partial, I admit, and of which this podcast aims to be part, has perhaps the capacity to bring a different voice, one in which state policies can be scrutinized honestly. So what do you think?
The question of the state domination of the media, I mean, look, in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, if you take Germany, France, and Britain, just those three, or Italy, you had plenty of media who were critical of the government. They could be centre left, centre right. You had the BBC, and you still have the BBC, which is state funded. But the BBC has been very critical of government policies.
Please allow me to clarify. I'm not saying that the media do not criticize the government. That's quite common to criticize the government. So the BBC may criticize the British government, that's fine, but that's not the issue. The issue is whether those channels are going to criticize the very principle of state intervention. Marine Le Pen criticized the government, but she would not criticize the principle of state intervention. By criticizing the government, generally they accuse the government of not doing enough. And they imply that the government could solve the problem if they want. That's the assumption that is prevailing in most of the media landscape, that the government is the key for the solution. But they will never consider that the government may be the key for the problem. The decentralization of information through social networks and YouTube, the internet, has the capacity to change this approach. The way people frame immigration today as a security problem, as a control problem primarily, one that calls for the state to intervene and solve the issue, is, in my view, deeply rooted in the premises of dominant media channels.
I think one of the great problems about today is it's probably more difficult to read the next 10 years than it ever has been in my lifetime. I mean, everything is changing at the same time. You know, 10 years of this, where are we going to be? I don't think anybody knows. I don't think anybody knows.
All right. Okay. So thank you. Thank you very much, Francis, for your views on this subject. And so please stay tuned on the States and Migration in Europe podcast, and we will soon start a new sub-series in the podcast. So thank you very much, Francis.
Thank you very much for having me.